What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
This is the new Weight Watchers, built for real life and real results, no matter what mode you're in. Maddie went all in for her big day and lost 33 pounds. Emily lost 85 pounds and hit her goal while still living her life.
Weight Watchers gave me the tools and I feel amazing.
Join the millions of members and lose weight with the number one doctor-recommended weight loss program. Lose more at WeightWatchers.com.
At 6 months, participants in a clinical trial of Weight Watchers program lost an average of 12 pounds.
Hello and welcome to The Katie Halper Show. Please rate and review The Katie Halper Show on iTunes and also support the show on Patreon. Patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Again, that's Patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. For $1 a month, you can be part of the show, help make it happen. For $5 a month, you get Patreon-only premium episodes. Again, that's Patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Again, Patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. This is an interview I did with Mike Duncan, the host of the Revolutions podcast, as well as the History of Rome. And we started talking about the steps towards revolution or collapse that he's predicting. And there was so much more to talk about that we're going to continue the discussion Sunday, September 13th at noon Eastern Standard Time. And that will be on my YouTube channel. And that's youtube.com/The Katie Halper Show. Again, that's youtube.com/The Katie Halper Show. And if you miss that, we'll be releasing it as a podcast. So without any further ado, Mike Duncan. Thank you so much for doing this podcast, for talking to me. Really excited to talk to you. I'm sure you get this a lot when people talk to you, but it's like, oh, it's so funny to hear your voice. I've heard it so much on the podcasts.
And it comes with a face.
Yeah. Who knew? I never knew.
Who knew? Yes. I'm not just a disembodied voice.
Yeah. You're not just a faceless, who was it? Was it Romulus who like vanished?
There were a few. Yeah. Romulus. Right. Romulus vanished.
Yeah. So you're not
under a whirlwind of knives wielded by the nobility.
Right. Yeah.
Good times.
Yeah.
Good times with Romulus. Yeah.
I was thinking like if his brother had won, would Rome be like Reem?
Yeah.
That would have been funny. Yeah.
Yeah. We would have called it Rem.
Rem, yeah.
And then the Rems would have, but you know, he probably would have been like chill and cool and not been like the kind of guy who would murder his own brother.
Right.
And would laced a completely different character into the Romans and we never would have heard of them.
Right. That's
you
true.
You gotta be founded by somebody who's willing to murder his own brother right. over order dispute.
Yeah. That's like the
Roman martial character.
Right. It's the personals ad for Roman leadership.
Yeah.
Of course, people I'm sure know that Mike Duncan is an historian, New York Times bestselling author, and one of the foremost history podcasters in the world. His award-winning first podcast series, The History of Rome, ran from 2007 to 2012 and led to two books, The History of Rome and The Storm Before the Storm, about the beginning of the end of the Roman Republic. And his second podcast series, Revolutions, traces the history of modern political revolutions from the English to the Russian. He currently lives in Paris and is working on his next book about the role of the Marquis de Lafayette in the American and French revolutions. So, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming. So I guess I wanted to ask you to start off about this tweet you wrote, the tweet that was read around the world, where you listed the conditions of revolution that you thought that the United States was perhaps meeting.
Yeah, well, it's something that I tossed off on Twitter because Twitter is a good place to toss things off
right.
and then walk away from them and come back and see what's happened. But I work in revolutions. I work in studying great, you know, chaotic moments in history. And what I study, you know, always ends up being a revolution, because otherwise I wouldn't be talking about it. But these things come from places, you know, social upheavals and economic contradictions and problems and political conflicts, that these things kind of come together, and they don't always produce revolutions, right? Some of them fade away. Some of them, you know, go in a reactionary direction, and sometimes they move in a revolutionary direction. But what I have noticed in America in 2020, which I can now view this from across the waters, as I have removed myself to self-imposed exile, is most of the conditions that I would put into an episode of the podcast series right before the episode where I say, okay, in today's episode, the revolution starts. Most of those things are present right now in the United States. It is, there's a lot of long-term structural factors and a lot of short-term conditions that would be very easy to write up into an episode that will probably, you just feel it peaking with the election. And so I tossed this off and I said, all the conditions are there. And then people said, well, what do you mean? With some concern, I think, probably in their voice. And so then, yeah, you guys reached out and said, we should talk about this. And I said, okay. And so I have actually now like jotted a lot of these things down. And it's no less concerning than it was when I tossed this off a couple weeks ago.
So should we just jump into the great listicle of revolutionary conditions?
Yeah.
Not to reduce it to a listicle, but.
Yeah, no. These 12 weird tricks to have your society collapse.
Right. 12-step program. It's a 12-step program towards collapse. Yeah.
I'll give them to you. Okay. I mean, so it's hard to even know whether to begin at the beginning or begin at the end. So I think I'm going to begin at the end.
Okay.
And the end of this is the election of 2020. And the election of 2020 is shaping up to be, can we swear on this show?
Yeah.
Okay. So the election of 2020 is going to be a fucking shit show.
Yeah.
Like this is absolutely going to be the case. And it's the case for a variety of different reasons. One of which being that we are moving in towards it with both Trump and the Republicans and Democrats believing that whatever happens on election day is going to be illegitimate, right? Because you have right now, you're like, I think really when I wrote the tweet, it was right when Trump was coming out and openly saying, I'm trying to crash the post office.
Right.
Because if the post office is functional, then people will vote by mail. People who don't want me to be president are voting by mail at a much, much higher level than people who want him to be president. I mean, it's like 80-20, if I think it's like one of the numbers that I saw. It's astronomically, people who vote by mail are going to be voting against Trump. So he's just like, let's crash the post office. This is, you know, a pretty naked assault on democracy, and it is in keeping with everything that, you know, Trump is about. But So Democrats are primed right now to believe whatever the vote total is, there were shenanigans. There has been and voter suppression is an issue that has been kicking around for 5 years, for 10 years, let's say, of aggressively attacking people's access to the polls. So there's a lot of people on the left who are going to view it as illegitimate. And then but at the same time that he's doing all of these things, he's also telling his voters, they're going to be stuffing ballot boxes. You know, they're going to steal this election, right? And if it goes against him, he's going to say, you know, it was, you know, they're coming in with these sacks of mail. He's not going to accept anybody telling him that he actually lost the election. So election night and election day plus one and election day plus two and election day plus three, though, that's going to be just insane, because whatever side loses is not going to accept that it was a legitimate loss. Now these things are born of like a number of different things, because when you have a revolution, broadly speaking, you need a bunch of political factors, you need a bunch of economic factors, you need a bunch of social factors. So politically speaking, obviously the biggest single issue is Donald Trump himself. Like, Donald Trump is an issue. He is the most, he's the single most salient political issue of the last 5 years, Trump himself. He is proto-authoritarian. He is incompetent. He is not amoral. He's not an amoral person. He's an immoral person, right? He's a bad person. Right. Like, if as I'm looking to my children who are like 8 and 5, and I'm trying to teach them how to be a good person in the world, Donald Trump basically checks every single box of what not to do. He's corrupt. Right. He's a liar. He's a misogynist. He's a racist. He is, I'm almost certain, a rapist, right? Yeah. I think that that's probably true. At a minimum, it's sexual assault. Sure. At a maximum, it's outright rape. He is lazy at his job, right? We entrust him with this job to be president of the United States, and he just doesn't care. He's literally golfing all the time. And I haven't actually, in the Revolutions podcast, haven't run into an executive or a political leader who is like as bad as Trump is. You know, Louis the 16th, Nicholas the 2nd, Charles the 1st of England, Charles the 10th of France. I mean, these guys are all famously so bad at being king and czar that they were overthrown in revolutions.
Right.
And all of them, I think, in terms of their own personal character and their own ability to do the job, are all better qualified and were better leaders than Donald Trump is. And these guys are famously the worst leaders in history.
Yeah.
So you got, I have to go back to the history of Rome and start looking at, the teenage emperors, right? Like Caligula and Nero and Commodus. That's the only place where you really find anybody who behaves the way that he behaves, like this badly, being this like sociopathically narcissistic. You don't find that kind of behavior in the Revolutions podcast. You find that in the history of Rome when you're talking about the worst emperors of all time. So we have that. Donald Trump himself has been, just an assault on the American psyche for like 5 years. And his whole MO is to find any cultural division, right? Any place that he can find conflict between Americans, whether it's people kneeling at a football game or whether it's, you know, cans of fucking black beans,
right?
Whatever it is that he can find, he is going to lean on it. He's going to rub salt in it. He's going to cram embers into it. And he is going to take all of our various cultural divisions and he's just going to exacerbate them and make them worse. So this has been going on now for 5 years, this steady assault, daily assault on our psyche, enabled, of course, by this coterie of these Republicans who enable him and cheer him on. So the people who loathe Donald Trump, which I loathe Donald Trump, the people who loathe him can loathe him, right? It's not a little thing. It's not like, oh, I don't like him very much. I would prefer him not to be president. It's like, I hate this guy. And I hate him because he has spent 5 years reveling in the fact that I hate him, making me hate him more and doing things specifically to make me hate him more. This whole own the libs theory of Republican governance, which is just like if it's good, if it makes liberals and Democrats mad. I mean, that's been a thing. This is fine. You've poked a bunch of people with a sharp stick for years and years and years and years. So people are actually pissed off at this guy. And the people who love Donald Trump have, of course, descended into an increasingly, like, this is actually like picking up steam in a way that even I wouldn't have thought possible. You know, like there already was a cult of personality around Trump that has been very troubling. But the way that QAnon has been ripping through the Facebook groups, you know, the way that it's coming up, sort of just saturating the brains of people who in other ways are perfectly normal are now coming out and, you know, saying like, did you know that Tom Hanks is a pedophile and that Donald Trump is going to like arrest him and kill him and it's going to be great? It's like, what the? What? So this is all happening. So the Trump himself as an issue is primed for some kind of revolutionary event, right? Some kind of revolutionary moment, which is either going to be you know, something against him or in favor of him. Right. And that's the thing. It's like sitting here right now, like, you know, you say, like, are you predicting a revolution in November of 2020? And it's not that I'm predicting a revolution in November of 2020, but I am going to openly predict that something is going to happen. Right. It's going to be structural and it's going to be big, and whether or not it moves in the direction of, you know, increasing the trend towards like American fascism and that, you know, that reactionary bent, or whether it does move into a sort of a popular democratic backlash against what he's been up to for the past 5 years. I don't know which one it would be, but it's going to be one of them.
Well, and also I think, like, if it doesn't turn into a like revolution as we've seen before, that in itself will tell us something about, you know, American society or history or, you know.
Right. And then again, maybe it will all just peter out, which I don't think is going to happen, though, because we have a number of other factors at our display. If it was just Trump, I, you know, it would just be like, this motherfucker. But, you know, everything else is great. So clearly the next biggest thing is COVID-19, which is, you know, you don't get things like the French Revolution or the Russian Revolution without severe without these kind of like environmental shocks. Right. Whether it's famine, an overly cold winter, people freezing, people can't afford bread, people can't afford fuel for their fires, like whatever it is, or like a literal plague, which is what we're dealing with. You know, this is a natural biological environmental factor that is just a complete wild card that has been thrown into the mix of an already, and we'll talk, I'll get into this later, but like an already pretty broken and fractured society has now been hit with this like biological environmental catastrophe, which is a plague that has forced everybody to stay home. It has resulted in, you know, massive job losses. It has resulted in massive insecurity. You know, people are trapped inside their homes.
Depression.
The service economy, the entertainment economy. You know, people aren't making TV shows. People aren't making movies. You know, many of the things that we rely on to sort of keep the liquid capital of the country moving and paying each other. You know, like we're, you know, receiving money and then spending money to keep the economy going. That all just sort of ground to a halt, which of course was all made worse by Donald Trump, who is incompetent and who aggressively decided to respond with massive amounts of disinformation and neglect, which made the entire thing worse.
You mean haven't found the bleach to be helpful?
No, I have not found the bleach to be helpful. I have not found Donald Trump to be helpful. And I live in France right now, which is, you know, you could say, like, so we did everything. I mean, I did a 23-hour-a-day lockdown in Paris, France, in a 50-square-meter apartment with my wife and two kids, and it was rough. Let me tell you, we all love each other, but it was hard. And it's not like the French or the European Union did anything perfectly, and we're probably right now having the second wave that everybody predicted, and school's about to start here, and we're going to see what that's like. But point being that it was handled quite a bit better here than it was in the United States. And this has, you know, proven again how unfit Trump is personally for office. But like the economic shock of this is like unlike anything we've ever seen, kind of. My big issue is that if you back up 10 years, you know, we go back 10 years, where are we at? We're at the 2008 economic crisis. I don't believe that the United States ever recovered from the 2008 economic crisis, financial crisis. You can see by any measure, the sort of the recovery that the country allegedly had, most of those gains, most of that new wealth, most of that new money and recovery money went to investors. It went to people who already had capital. It went to sort of the 1% of the United States of America. They are the ones who gained the most. The vast majority of workers, the vast majority of people in the middle classes and lower classes saw their wages stagnate. They certainly didn't go up, and many oftentimes went down. The jobs that then became available to make it look like the unemployment rate is lower now and people are having their jobs back. Those jobs are riskier. Those jobs are less secure. Those jobs come with less pay and fewer benefits. They come, you know, we have moved towards this gig economy that has started to absorb large parts of the workforces. So you can say, oh, well, this person has a job, so they're not on the unemployment rolls, but also their company is saying they're not employees. So that has created, I mean, the precariat, which is a vocabulary word I picked up at one point a couple years ago. The precariat is great. As soon as somebody told me there's this thing that this word I can use called precariat, it's like, Jesus, it's just a huge chunk of the American economy is a part of this horrible precariat who don't have any kind of security, don't have any kind of reliability, and people have families that they can't count on having these jobs. And, you know, you just get this feeling that the whole mentality of like move fast and break things that came out of Silicon Valley, you know, the principal thing that they moved fast and broke was 150 years worth of worker protections, safeties, unions, benefits, secure job security, anything. And even, you know, before I went into my forest seclusion to finish the book, you know, Uber and Lyft are out there threatening to shut down in California because they can't pay their quote unquote not actually employees a wage. Okay, so this is like, this is the economics of America in the 2020. This is I don't think that people ever recovered from 2008, and I think that then have just been leveled by this second meteor strike. You know, we had one, we were wobbling, and then we got blasted again by COVID. So,
and also just really quickly, like
jump in whenever you want. If you ever want to break up this monologue,
no, it's great. I'm totally enthralled. But it's interesting that it's so funny that this isn't getting more coverage. But you know how climate change also did contribute to COVID, and it's weird that like I don't know, Dems should be various reasons they're not. But it's funny how little attention that's received, because that is such a great opportunity to warn against that. Because the bats, crazy bats.
An ineffectual opposition.
Yes, right. That's is that on the list? Okay, good.
Let's see, where was I?
You were, I think you were going into number three.
They are technically numbered, but also like, so we're also dealing, and I haven't checked back on this, but like there was some effort, you know, in the early summer to do some unemployment benefit bonuses and give out some money. It was, you know, entirely too little. It was entirely too late and lasted entirely not long enough. Which is the kind of thing that you see, like, again, if I was writing an episode, you would say, okay, you have this massive economic crisis and you have the powers that be saying like, okay, kicking and screaming, we will be dragged into giving you some money that did kind of help, you know, like there are good indications that that actually like really did help get like literally just putting money in people's pockets, which is something I'm very much in favor of, just direct cash infusions. But then they just have since walked away from it. And there were eviction moratoriums, right? And those eviction moratoriums are going to start to wind up. And when are they going to start to wind up? They're going to start to wind up in the fall of 2020, leading into this, you know, leading into this election. And again, that's the same way that we were, you know, we're dealing with an economic crisis that's coming on top of an economic crisis that we already hadn't gotten out of, which was 2008, homelessness and houselessness and people losing their homes and not being able to afford homes. This has been an issue that especially the coasts have been dealing with for 10 years. Right. You know, I'm from Seattle originally. I don't live there anymore, but I lived in Seattle. I lived in Portland. I've spent a lot of time in Vancouver. My family is from San Francisco. My mom is from San Francisco originally. So I've been to all these Vancouver, BC.
Yeah.
Right.
Remember you said.
It's like even the Canadians are dealing with this, right? Like there is
a Vancouver, Washington, right? BC.
Just over from Portland. We were already dealing with housing crisis.
Yeah.
And this is all just making all of those things worse. And that's what happens when I say, you know, these things need to come together in a certain way. It's making things that were already bad even worse,
yeah.
right? Things aren't getting better. Things are being worse.
Yeah. And
all of this would be bad on its own, but it's hitting things that were already quite terrible, you
yeah.
know, like insecurity and inability to do all these things. So what the heck is next on my list? I did actually make a list. Oh gosh, yes. Who are the ones who are feeling all of this the most? It's anyone under the age of 40 years old.
Yeah.
Right? Because there is a generational divide that has been growing up, and I think, again, was exacerbated by the experience of 2008, where if you had kind of already achieved a certain level of job security and financial security and owned a home and had gotten to a certain point in your life, you were able to ride all of that pretty easily. If you were under the age, today under the age of 40, so back then if you were 30 and below, you know, trying to make your place in the world for anybody under the age of 40, start a family, buy a home, you know, have a career, climb some kind of ladder to advance beyond just entry level nonsense, or advance beyond just like a gig economy where everybody is told, oh, well, you prize flexibility. Didn't you know that? And it's like,
yeah.
I don't prize flexibility. I prize knowing that I'm going to have a paycheck
right.
and knowing that I'm going to have a job and knowing that in 5 years, maybe I can be higher and have more responsibility and more money than I do right now, which I don't think is the experience of most young people. And by young people, I mean, people who are 33 with two kids,
right?
You know, which is, people talk about millennials to this day. And by people, I mean baby boomers.
Right.
Baby boomers still talk about millennials like they're, you know, 18 years
right.
old. And it's like millennials are, you know, 35
yeah.
and they've never known this thing called the American dream of which you speak, which is, you know, go to university, get an education, find a wife, find a husband, get married, have kids,
yeah.
get a career, buy a home, move up in the ladder, wherever it is, you know. And, you know, obviously we're not doing, you know, spend 30 years at the same corporation
right.
anymore, but you, at least when you leave one place and go to another place, you're moving up, you know, you're taking a higher position. And not only are we not seeing that, but we are seeing jobs being shed, people being laid off. What kinds of people are being laid off? Journalists are being laid off. You know, it is, you know, it is a bloodbath out there
yeah.
for journalists. And, you know, this is one of those things where I haven't done a revolution that doesn't involve a lot of really pissed off journalists.
Oh, that's a really interesting point. Yeah,
you know, right. they, you know, and on top of that, a group of educated people, because I mean,
right.
it's the highest university rates, highest college graduate rates of practically any generation, highly educated, but not left with anything
yeah.
that is satisfying or dignifying.
Right.
So, and
didn't
this
they
is,
do
this
study about suicide bombers, I think, or that like people expected, you know, the kind of your intuition or would suggest, oh, if you're a suicide bomber, you come from like the most desperate, the poorest, you have nothing to lose. But they found that, like, not surprisingly, and this kind of this does relate to what you're saying, the people most likely to become suicide bombers are people who experienced kind of a gap, an expectation gap,
right.
right? So they moved from like the countryside into the city. They were the first college educated in their family, and then they don't have so they experienced some upward mobility, but not as much as they were promised.
Right.
And yeah.
I have also seen those things.
Yeah.
Right, where it's not just like poor people coming
right.
out of the slums doing this, right?
Right.
Exactly. So
it can be radicalizing, is I guess.
Yeah,
right.
can be radicalized. And also, I mean, what we're talking about here is just like, you know, what is the collective amount of stress, insecurity, anger, and fear that is growing up out there? And I think that it has been growing for a decade or more. I mean, you can trace these things back further than that, but let's just say a decade or more, that are now being even more acutely felt right now. And I feel like every time I open up, you know, social media, I'm looking at somebody else who just lost their job.
Yeah.
And this is somebody or left the industry, or we're also talking about you know, this another group that I have a lot of contact with is people who are in academia and in the universities. And we, you know, we know that this is another one of these things that's been going on for 10 or 15 years. This move towards adjunct professors, you know, creating this absolute class of exploited academics who aren't getting tenure track jobs, who aren't being paid a decent wage, who are getting these 3-month at-will contracts to like work their asses off. And maybe they'll get picked up in 3 months and maybe not. And like, if you're trying to, like, we're not pure nomads here. You can't just like pick up and fly somewhere else. If the, well, you know, this year I worked in Virginia, but next, you know, next semester I can go to Arizona.
Right. And that's especially fun. Even more than ever with COVID, like we're that more mobile.
Right. And so, a lot, you know, people coming out of grad school. So every university is a hotbed of anger and resentment and, you know, and fury, right? Really, I think all of these things have been growing. And, you know, I spent 5 years living in Madison, Wisconsin. So I was pretty close to what was happening to the University of Wisconsin system, which was basically under sustained assault by Scott Walker and by the Republicans, who more or less wanted to gut and destroy the university system, turn it into like a STEM technical college that no longer would cause them any hassles because they saw it as one of the as a hotbed of Democrats, right? That this is where Democrats are, and they just want to destroy anything that where Democrats might be.
Lazy slobs. What was that disgusting guy? Grossman, I think his name is literally like Glenn Grossman, some congressman who called the people protesting a bunch of like lazy, smelly slobs. And, you know, I don't usually take this route, but it's just funny because the guy is, I'll just say he's not the most attractive man. So it's just interesting to hear him talk about anyone else's appearance or aesthetics. Yeah, Glenn Grossman. I mean, the name is perfect too. Yeah.
And Wisconsin has been a microcosm of all of this stuff, but because voter suppression is going to come into this too, obviously. So we have those kinds of people, and then you have just your run of the mill, just sort of like average American family, right? Like middle class family. We all know who these people are,
right?
And all of them have also been hit by COVID. All of them have also been hit by the same economic insecurity, by potential layoffs, and not just layoffs, but the potential of layoffs. I mean, that's the thing. It's not just losing your job. It's knowing that you could at any moment, the next email you get could be the one that says you don't have a job anymore. Yes. Like that
uncertainty and anxiety.
It lives in your heart, man. It lives in your brain. And you have to live like this while also, you know, you've got, you know, Johnny and, you know, Jenny, who are 12 and 8 and who need to go to school. Meanwhile, you and your husband or you and your wife both need to work full time in order to keep these precarious jobs that you're afraid of losing. And you've been trapped inside your house for months on end. And the president has done such a horrible job that, you know, you can't even have the grandparents come over and help. And the grandparents are like, I've got parents, you know, obviously they're furious.
Yeah.
You know, not only are they worried about catching the plague, which is bad. They also can't see their grandkids.
Yeah.
Grandchild deprivation, man. Seniors are pissed about this, and they're pissed at Trump about it. I mean, it's very, cause he's to blame for it for the most part.
Right.
You know, my parents can't cross. I don't know when I'm going to see my parents again because, you know, I don't know when the European Union is ever going to be foolish enough to let Americans into this country, which, you know, right now I wouldn't do it.
Right.
So, not to mention
all the isolated people, the single, like the people living at home. I mean, it's just like, I keep forgetting. I mean, it's horrible, but I'm blessed with, I'm not in New York City, which is where I live. And I'm here with my parents and dogs and a family friend. And every now and then I'm like, oh, this sucks, which it does. It sucks. But then I remember it's like there are people who are trapped in a city and they cannot. I mean, the depression rates and, you know, domestic violence rates, as you referred to in the opening of your last as your like hiatus intro podcast. But it's just. Yeah. And it really is heartbreaking, you know, think elderly people and people just like locked in.
And it's really true. Thank you for that. Because it is like it's a tale of two COVIDs, right. I feel like, because, and yeah. I'm coming at this, like, I have an 8-year-old and a 4-year-old. Totally. So for me, it was like, we are on top of each other.
Right.
And like, when lockdown finally like released, it's like, all I want to do is just go stand in a field and not look right. at anybody and not talk to anybody. Right. And just give me some
right.
space.
Right.
But yeah.
And of on course, the other I, side, it's the
And
opposite,
on the other
right?
side is somebody who is so desperate for any kind contact. Of real human contact yeah. because they haven't had it. So I don't think that we should ever, I mean, like, and you just did it too, right? Put on a brave face.
Yeah.
Which is, it's not that bad for me.
Yeah.
Other people have it worse, you know, and everybody says this. Yeah. I say this, but like, it's bad for everybody.
Yeah.
And it is having an impact on each one of our individual psyches, and collectively
right.
that kind of trauma. We have been traumatized in
yeah.
one way, shape, or form for the last, you know, however long it's been now, 6 months, we have been enduring daily trauma. That
yeah.
we have been putting aside, that we have been putting on a brave face.
Sure.
We're saying, okay, well, let's get through one more day. But this shit is building up
yeah.
and it has been building up. And then like, so, okay, I haven't even talked about the mother of all whammies that also comes into this, which is the oldest problem that America has dealt with, that America has not dealt with, and has actively made worse going on 400 years now, which is race relations
right.
in the United States of America, which on top of COVID and Trump, which Trump made everything worse, which is partly why this is all blowing up specifically right now. But you have suddenly some of the largest protests in American history that are happening in cities across the country that involved clashes with police, most of which, in my opinion, were exacerbated by the police,
yeah.
right? Where you have a lot of peaceful protesters coming together. And because it was against the police were like, well, you know, one empty water bottle goes flying and it's here comes the tear gas and the batons.
Right.
Right. Like, and I lived in Portland for 6 years. Like, I wrote most of the history around when I was in Portland. So like, I know all of those places, and I know a lot of those people. And I, you know, watched what was happening in Seattle, which is another city that I know quite well. And all of these places, I mean, the clashes between the authorities and the people, right? And the way I think that there was a great deal of radicalization that went on in those moments is people got together to say Black Lives Matter. And this, you know, this continued mistreatment of the African-American community by the powers that be, by the police, by, you know, just by a host of ongoing factors that, you know, America was founded on, essentially. I'm going to protest these things, and then having the police come in with batons and crack heads. I think that has led to a much more confrontational attitude on both sides. So if, for example, you get to the point in November of 2020, when there are going to be protests against Trump, or the other way, I guess, I feel like this is going to be happening in a certain way. But when that happens, it is going to be a rekindling of the same people who were on the two sides of the lines in June and July are going to be back on those same two sides of the lines in November and December.
Mm-hmm.
And there's going to be a lot less willingness to do anything but just fight it out.
Yeah.
So like in the French Revolution, there was this moment called the Réveillon Riot, which is right before the convening of the Estates General in 1789, where there was a protest that led to, a little riot, and the people broke into a factory and they started trashing the joint. And then these soldiers came down and they were ordered to open fire on the crowd, and they opened fire on the crowd, and maybe like 50 or 100 people got killed. So this is like in April of 1789, and this is in the Faubourg Saint-Antoine. This is right in the shadow of the Bastille, where this happened. And then you fast forward 2 months to July, right, which is when the Bastille fell. That was the same people in the same neighborhood, you know, that had now been just 2 months earlier been attacked by the guards. And so they were at an even more heightened sort of fever pitch. And on top of that, the guards themselves who had been ordered to fire on these people were not too happy about the fact that they had just basically murdered a bunch of people who they had a lot more in common
right.
with than officers. And so a lot of them defected across the line and helped take down the Bastille. But these these protests that have been going on all through the summer, you know, that can become a major prelude to what goes on in some kind of election day plus one political emergency, which could very well happen. And it's attempting to address the thing that is America's greatest sin, which is its ongoing racism against really all people of color, but specifically the African-American community. The other great sin being indigenous genocide, but focusing specifically on what white America has done to black America for 400 years.
Well, in large part because there are not as many indigenous people around because of said founding.
Right. There is this thing where for white America, black America is the great boogeyman.
Right.
And indigenous America is the forgotten ghost.
Yeah.
And those are the things that's the lens through which I think a lot of white America views the country. Yeah. And so there is this reckoning with, you know, some of our deepest racial divisions, all of which are exacerbated specifically by Trump, who has run on an explicitly racist platform since he first announced his candidacy.
Warning us about the Mexican rapists.
Exactly. Warning us about the Mexican rapist, said the big fat white rapist.
Right.
So that's cool. So now all of this is going on. You've got a literal plague. You have one of the greatest economic shocks to the American economy. You know, it's right up there with the Great Depression and the Great Recession. You have social stress, insecurity, anger, fear. You have this political crisis, which is Donald Trump himself being proto-authoritarian, and then the Republican Party in general. So now we're building towards this election again. We're going back now towards the election, and they are aggressively assaulting voting rights, and they are going to make it very difficult for people to vote them out of office. The gerrymandering has already structurally contributed to the way that the House of Representatives works. The states themselves are an act of gerrymandering to create the Senate to be the way that the Senate is. State legislatures and state houses in many places are affected by this. In Georgia, in Florida, in Wisconsin, where I spent 5 years, where we would do a state election. 50% of the voters would vote for a Democratic candidate. 50% of the voters would vote for a Republican candidate. And you look at the assembly, which is 99 seats, and 66 of them are Republican and 33 are Democrat. And you're like, this, I don't know how else to say this. This isn't fair. There's really no other way to say it. That's not fair. So I'll just say it like that. And so
the
so
unfariat, trying to do the precariat. Yeah. You know?
Right. We're the unfariat. It's just like at a certain point, you know, Trump lost the fucking election.
Yeah.
You know, we know that he lost the election by 3 million votes. And we're heading into what is bound to be another close election because America can't look at everything that Donald Trump has done and vote him out of office 90-10 because we don't live in that world. So it'll be close. And their whole strategy involves tanking the election, closing polling places, making it difficult for certain people in certain parts of the country to vote. Yeah. I think that it was very clear that the decision to send in those federal troops, like whatever they were, like the federal gang guys to Portland, which was about number one, getting good viral video art for their own campaign, but also to test what it would look like and how it would work and what it would do. And you know, Barr has said, I will be making the final decision when and where the unrest will be such that I might have to deploy these forces. And you just get the feeling like, okay, well, let's just find a swing state and the city and the black neighborhood, and that's where they're going to go, because they are going to attempt to intimidate voters into not leaving their homes in Detroit, in Milwaukee, right, in Cleveland. So all of that is we're now leading right back up into it. And there is this other side, because you can't have a revolution and you can't have unrest without you know, there really being two sides of this. And we touched on this a little bit, and I think I am actually getting to the end of this list here. I hope.
What
I hope
number?
I hope this is enough, right? I think this is 12 or 13.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah.
We can go highlight the names of it.
Yeah, which is just the insane levels of just like toxic radicalization in the right wing, in amongst conservative circles, coming out of these Facebook groups and coming out of YouTube, QAnon. You have what's the other? Oh yeah, the Boogaloo guys, yeah. Right? The Civil War II Electric Boogaloo people, these 3%er militias, right? Which are all sort of like coalescing around each other. They are being encouraged by Trump. They are being encouraged by Republicans. I know that the Texas Republican Party is openly selling, you know, like the coming storm merch, right? Which is just a straight play to QAnon. And QAnon is really just like a crazy fascist fantasy, which is when you get to the end of what QAnon thinks is going to happen, it is the great savior Donald Trump is going to arrest and eliminate these debauched homosexual pedophile liberals who have been destroying the moral fabric of the country and who need to be purged. I mean, it's really sick and twisted stuff once you get to the end. And people are being brought into it, you know, by being told like, oh, you know, there's child trafficking rings and this is a big concern. But they don't see how much what they're being led to is insane. And the problem with all of this, of course, is that we do have things like Jeffrey Epstein, and we do have people like Bill Cosby, who are living proof that it doesn't matter, you know, like especially like with Bill Cosby. I mean, Bill Cosby is living proof that it doesn't matter how good you seem to be in public, you can be for your entire life a serial rapist. And you can just say, well, it's not that crazy. I mean, look at Bill Cosby. I mean, look at the circle around Jeffrey Epstein.
Right.
Like, it's not like these things don't exist in the world. So
then
he's like,
it's bipartisan. I mean, like we have Trump and Bill Clinton hanging out with Epstein.
Bill Clinton's, oh boy, he's in all this stuff, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, Bill Clinton is, boy howdy. I think that that's most of it. I'm sure there's like at least a half dozen other things that I'm probably forgetting, but that's like, so now I have to sit down and write a 5,000 word, you know, sort of like, let's sum up the state of affairs so that next week, you know, in the, you know, the infamous election of America of November 2020, you know, these are the things that fed into this. And these are all the same things that I would have described to set up the revolutions of 1848, which was, you know, like a potato famine.
Big year,
you know, a potato famine leading into some, and then there were some other crop failures leading into a business recession and a financial crisis. You had overly educated Germans who couldn't find jobs in the bureaucracy. You know, like so that was all of that. 1830, same thing. You know, the great French Revolution of 89, same thing. All of these things. This is just what happens. And the ones that I talk about become political revolutions. So maybe something will happen, maybe nothing will happen, but all the fire's there. It's already on fire. Speaking of climate change, California's on fire because of climate change. So you've got infernos come. There was this picture that I saw that was like, this is 2020. Did you see this picture?
Yeah.
Like please wear your mask.
Yeah.
And it's just
at a fire. Yeah. Well, that's the nice thing is like when it's on fire, ostensibly, one would hope the COVID is not, you know, all the germs are killed. So, right. So if you want to hang out in a fire, like when you're sitting in it, in eternal damnation, you don't have to worry about germs.
Yeah.
What you mentioned, ineffectual opposition. Is that part of the, that's something I'm kind of focused on a lot. And I think that, and it's funny, like, so Michael Moore is constantly trending because he got the election right last time. And now he's saying again, he's like, look, don't underestimate Trump. And he's not a Trump fan. Like people, you may have seen his movie Fahrenheit 11/9. And I bring that up though, because there is there is a cognitive dissonance and denial where Trump is this existential, unprecedented threat, Cito Mussolini, and also we got this.
Right.
And that's a dangerous combination.
Right. They made a decision, I don't even know when, to put every single egg in America's basket into we will beat him
right.
in November 2020.
Right.
And if that doesn't happen, then yeah, which obviously it could not happen.
Right.
Right. And I would sit here and I would tell you also do not underestimate him.
Right.
Do not underestimate the American electoral system producing exactly the same outcome that right. it produced in 2016, which is him losing by 3 million votes and
right.
winning
and
the
winning
presidency.
The, right.
And,
we have
and having,
the electoral
and having
college,
nothing
yeah.
that anybody can actually do about right. it. Because they have continued to play like they could have impeached him. They could have been exposing his corruption. They
yeah.
could have been exposing all of the things that he has done wrong and kept
right.
up a constant drumbeat of this guy is corrupt. This guy is bad. This guy does terrible things. Here's another terrible thing. And they just decided that that would be a poor strategy. They actively moved to make impeachment come and go as quickly as they could humanly make it go quickly. So that it wasn't on the table,
mm.
right? In the election.
Right.
So, you know, I'm not in Washington, D.C. I don't actually know what it is that they're thinking. I do know that like in 2018, Pelosi's big takeaway from 2018 was that they didn't win back the House because of people like Ocasio-Cortez or
yeah.
or those really deep blue seats. They won it because they got a lot of these
suburban,
sort of suburban
yeah.
like freaked out suburban moderates
right.
who
right.
voted a certain way. And so they didn't want to like they're very timid.
Yeah.
Though. That's the thing, is they're very, very timid. And I do think that there is a vacuum
yeah.
of opposition, right?
Right.
That at the same time, a lot of people voted for them to take back the House
yeah.
to be oversight, right? To be a check, right? There are checks and balances
yeah.
in the American system.
And I think also, it's yeah. Have you read Listen, Liberal by Thomas Frank?
No.
It's really good. And one of his big theses, the main thesis is that like Democrats often pretend that they oppose something, and we often think of Dems, and they are this. They can be inept and they can be spineless, but there are certain times where they actually want the thing that they're pretending to resist. And if they actually really didn't want it, they would fight against it effectively.
Right.
And so you see that with like the Pentagon or Trump, you know, this guy, you want this guy to have more money. You want his war machine to be more funded. You know, all these Dems who voted against slashing the Pentagon by 10%, which would have brought it to Obama levels.
Right.
And I mean, I don't know. I'm a big Bernie person. I also think that like not having him. I mean, I'm separating this from my own like liking of him. I actually just think that that like that was not a good look. The moderate consolidation, of course, it's the right of everyone to do that, like if they want to drop out in a coordinated way. But I do think that there are people who I think Sanders had the biggest ability to peel away Trump voters. That's what I'll say.
Yeah. I mean, it's two theories. There's two competing theories
yeah.
of how you get Trump voters. I do think it speaks to what the party is capable of when it puts its mind to it.
Yeah.
And you would like to see them,
right.
you know, have
imagine
that same
if they did
kind
that.
Of
yeah.
verve,
discipline
verve
and, verve,
and energy
yeah. right.
and unity and
right.
discipline when it comes to actually fighting, you know, like the real
yeah.
enemy,
right.
which is,
right.
You know, which is proto-authoritarian,
right.
which then, of course, yes, then they turn around and say like, oh, Trump is the, you know, the worst thing in the history of the United States. It's like, oh, okay, cool. Can we
yeah.
do something
right.
about him, please?
Let's sign the
no, we can't.
Sign the offensive military budget. Also, the other thing is that this is just, this is more getting into the Trump dynamic, but I do think that what sometimes liberals don't get is how Trump fans see him. And how the unmotivated base sees the world. And the Trump's major get out of jail free card is that he, as you said, he's immoral, but he's also amoral. I think he's both. And he never pretends to have any kind of political, ideological conviction or consistency.
Right.
So when he points out Hunter Biden
And MSNBC freaks out. They're like, how could he possibly say that when he's such a nepotist, which he is. Trump is a nepotist and he's incredibly corrupt. But that's not against his brand. That doesn't violate his brand the way it does with Biden or any other Democrat, let's say, right? And quite frankly, many Republicans, but not as much as the Dems, I don't think. Anyway, that's it. Whatever. Let's table that for a second. And the thing that Sanders has, and it's amazing. I mean, watching, it's almost genius, ingenious watching Trump go at people from, he'll go from the left or the right, and he'll do it in the same speech, right? And you remember in 2016, he went after Hillary Clinton for using the term super predator. And this is a guy who wrote an op-ed in the Daily News calling for the death penalty to be reinstated after the Central Park Five. I mean, this is a guy who is not a good on criminal justice stuff and racially coded language.
Excuse me. He's done more for black people than any president in American history.
They love him. The blacks. They love him. I have a great relationship with the blacks, as he used to say.
Yeah, he said so. So it must be true.
I know. And he calls them the blacks. So that's a good sign that you have a great relationship with them. But the thing is that, like, Sanders is someone who does not have a lot of inconsistency and hypocrisy. And that's the one area that I do think that Trump, it's like, it is his kryptonite, because he doesn't, it's asymmetrical warfare. Like, he doesn't have to live by those rules, and everyone else does.
Right.
So,
and other people, and he, you know, it really goes to show, you know, the power of shamelessness in small d democratic politics, which actually, like, Bill Clinton used to be like my big example for this.
Yeah.
Like, what you can get away with if you literally have no shame.
Yeah.
That if you look at Clinton's run through the 92 primaries, like, a normal person would not have been able to survive that level of humiliating scrutiny, which he went through as all of his affairs were coming to light, and all of these things that he had done, like, because he was just kind of like this kind of slimy Arkansas politician, with obviously with huge issues on with women,
sister soldier moment, and executing Ricky Ray Richter, and
And the fact that he was able to move through those scandals and come back from it and be, you know, the comeback kid, right? The comeback kid thing from 92, which I'm old enough to remember all this stuff because I was young and precocious at the time. But all of that is premised on him not having a human level of shame,
right?
Which, you know, if that had happened to me, if I had done all those things and then it was coming out in the press, I would be like, oh my God, I can't handle this. I'm out of here.
Right.
But he did. And so I used to be able to point to Bill Clinton and say, it's amazing what you can get away with in this country if you literally have no shame. And then Donald Trump,
he blew that out of the water. Yeah. Because Clinton pretended to have, remember, like, he tried to affect this almost Jimmy Carter, like, self-flagellation. I mean, he didn't at all, but he kind of gestured towards that, right? For misleading the American people after. I mean, I think you're right that it is there, and he couldn't care less. But he had an affect of kind of Christian redemption narrative.
Yeah, that's really true. But and Trump has none of these things.
Even though he's an incredibly strong Christian, his Christianity is incredibly. You know, they asked him about the IRS auditing him, and he's like, I think it may be because of my incredibly strong Christianity.
Yeah, he kind of is like a mass murderer at this point, like, you know, for what you can actually hang on him. But, you know, he's like the worst human being. It would be hard to construct an individual with more distasteful ways of behaving. Yeah. Than Trump, which is this whole other thing, like, and this gets back to you know, sort of like what is the actual opposition to Trump? Because I remember Susan Collins, like, saying, you know, if he would just stop being so vulgar, then I could support him to the hilt. And you're like, well, what about all the other stuff?
Yeah.
Like, his actual vulgarity is the least objectionable thing about him.
And I actually think that that's the big thing that is just a distraction. His tweets and his decorum, like, that's not the problem. And also, that's why the people who love him love him. So when people go after him for that, it's like, fuck yeah, I love that stuff about him. That's why I like him. And I think for the base, the base who may stay home. It's like, that's really that. I don't care about that part about it. Like, right. You know, I care about my jobs or not having jobs. And I really do think that like Sanders' ability to speak to, in fact, something that struck me as, and you as someone who studies revolutions, like historically, you don't really defeat right-wing populism with moderate stuff. Like you swing it out with left-wing populism. And you know, there's almost this purity politics coming from kind of centrists where if you even appeal to these, you know, deplorables, that's bad. When, of course, you want someone to appeal to these quote unquote deplorables who says, you're angry, you're in pain, I get it. Blame corporate greed. Don't blame, you know, your Black and Latino brothers and sisters, whatever, as opposed to saying blame Muslims and Black people.
Right.
And that's the thing that people don't get, I think. Well, one of the things.
Yeah, and I think because when you picture who the quote unquote gettable
right.
Trump voter is, right? When you talk to the people who coalesced around when the people who coalesced around Joe Biden,
right.
They are picturing suburban moms.
Right.
And they are picturing dentists and insurance agents and people who live in the suburbs.
Right.
Who, you know, are kind of like just run of the mill and always white, for example.
Yeah.
Let's be clear about that too. You're picturing like white people in the suburbs who you don't want to freak them out with, you know, with the crazy communist,
right.
You know, with Uncle Bernie, the crazy communist. And because a lot of those same voters, when you look at who votes in a general election,
right.
And we all, and every, you know, it's always older people who vote more, and it's always younger people who vote less. And then when those younger people grow up, they vote more, and the new younger people vote less.
Yeah.
It's that's the way it works. And so all those voters grew up in the Cold War and were absolutely, you know, just saturated in a Cold War mentality that didn't just make. There was like a double thing that went on. It didn't just make communism bad, right? Which of course it did. Like the communists are the bad guys, but it also taught everybody that Americans don't want any of those things, right?
Yeah,
that was the other thing. Not only is it bad, but also
it's unpopular.
We don't want those things, and people don't like these things, and that's not the way Americans do things.
And
I think that's a story that started getting told. That, you know, and what we're talking about here is like unions and healthcare and lots of things that are very, very, very popular. Yeah.
That happened, like the GI Bill that happened, you know.
Totally. And, you know,
New Deal,
tuition rates subsidized at 90%. And, you know,
having all of these
social programs. And man, when Trump, like what happened when Trump actually like cracked into the Republican field? Like, how did he do that? He did that by saying, these assholes want to take your Social Security. These assholes want to take your Medicare. I'm not crazy like these dumb. I'm not crazy like these people. I'm not Scott.
Not a radical austerity.
I'm not one of these lunatics. I'm not going to take your stuff away from you.
And far, no more endless wars.
Right. So he had a thing that was going on
that is still
like Herrenvolk socialism thing that he was pitching, which is very scary when the next person comes along and picks up that baton because that baton still exists, and can be picked up. Trump, obviously, he's so uninterested in actually governing that he did then give legislative agenda over to the very people who he'd been criticized in the primary.
Swamp.
But so. Yeah, the centrists are picturing, you know, all of those suburban voters as the ones to get. And what you're talking about is, you know, the people who are angry and disaffected, these anti-establishment people who exist in the precariat, who exist in who don't have an American dream to look forward to, who don't have a future, who don't have any kind of feeling of dignity or the possibility of progress.
Right.
There is a lot of depression. There is a lot of drug abuse. There is a lot of suicide out there. And yes, absolutely. And that's what Bernie Sanders is going to be pitching.
Right.
And I think that I think that either one of them could make that, you know, make a strong case.
Yeah.
And the thing that I think that, you know, it's.
But Sanders also, just really quickly about, I think that there's this myth that what you would do to get the disaffected white working class is it's like a false dichotomy. Like you can get them or you can get the unmotivated base, right? And you have to go to one. You can't, if you go to them, then you're going to throw Black people and LGBTQ people and women under the bus. And it's just not true, because all the programs that you would pitch to the white working class are programs that actually poll very well and disproportionately help people of color.
Yeah, they wind up structurally doing redistributive work that you actually need to go on. Right. And it's very popular with those people. So, and the other thing that I think that Sanders had going for him is that I mean, this gets into a little bit more like psychology about what we're looking for in a leader. People respond to strong leaders.
They do,
people who are confident and speak forthrightly, and people who speak in simple terms in a confident way,
and good storytellers. Like,
and you could see this anytime that there was a debate. Is like, people do know what mealy-mouthed, mushy, politicky, you know, bullshit sounds like.
Yeah,
and when you're talking out of both sides of your mouth, and it's all been it's all been focus grouped and focus tested, like, we know what that sounds like, and it sounds weak,
right?
And it sounds like tired, and it sounds like nothing I want to listen to.
And not trustworthy.
And it sounds really untrustworthy. Right. That's true. And you could see this in the debates when, you know, Sanders would come out and say, like, you know, like, four simple declarative sentences in a row, and you're just like,
and that's honestly, I think, what counterbalances, you know. I know people, because I'm in like not upstate New York, but an area of New York that's not the city, and there are people here who are have Trump signs, you know, have signs that say like pass the gas about fracking, and they hate socialism, but they think that Bernie, they trust Bernie Sanders.
Right.
Like, it's a very interesting thing that happens. And I think you have a lot of people who, a lot of people say, well, I disagree with him on certain things, but I trust him and I think he's a good man. And I do think that, and it's funny because it's like Trump is consistent in his not giving a shit. Sanders is consistent in his giving a shit. And then the mealy mouth people in the middle are not. Do you know what I mean? There's like,
I do. Yeah. And I think that people feel that.
Yeah.
And I think that, and then I think that on the other side, you know, the Joe Biden campaign is, let's just, and to a certain degree, COVID is the greatest thing that ever happened to Joe Biden. The fact that he is required by science and health officials to sit in his basement and not actually do anything is really quite helpful for him, because it has kept him out of the limelight. And so that theory is, don't make a move.
Right.
Don't be threatening. Don't do anything. Don't make a mistake. Let Trump continue to flail and ruin this, that he's crashed the economy. There's really nothing that the Republicans could have done going into this election to make their electoral prospects worse, right? The way that they behaved about spreading disinformation about COVID, the way that they have behaved, because this is another thing on the list, like the whole, like, we need another relief package going into the fall, and then actually just going on recess for a month and not taking care of it. Like, that level of abdication of responsibility is like literally like breaking of the social contract levels of neglect and negligence by your elected officials, which is something that just happened, which is the kind of thing that Mitch McConnell ought to be doing when he's trying to defeat President Hillary Clinton and make things as bad for President Hillary Clinton as he possibly can.
Right.
You spread disinformation about COVID. You stall the reform, you stall the aid packages.
Right.
You make sure that as many people lose their jobs as possible. Right. And everybody is just like pissed and wants and is not getting what they need. You do all those things against, if your opponent is sitting in the White House, they did all of these things. And Trump is the one in the White House.
Right.
It's absolutely bananas how much they, and even with all of that, we're still sitting here looking at, you know, it's going to come down to the wire. It's going to come down to a couple 10,000 votes, and you never really know which way it's going to swing. But what I do think is true is that whatever happens in November, it's going to not be good.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, not having, and so that now the question becomes to keep this on what happens when you have an ineffectual
opposition,
right? Let's just paint a scenario where Trump declares victory, he wins, It's maybe because of Electoral College shenanigans. It is maybe because of voter suppression shenanigans. There's lots now anecdotal evidence of trashing of ballots and, you know, polling play. There's 30 lawsuits that are going on, you know, 50 lawsuits going every which way. And it all goes to where? It goes to the Supreme Court, which is another thing that is on the list that I just remembered, but I didn't write it down for this. But let's not forget that time. SCOTUS has been itself fatally made illegitimate by both the double whammy of like the Merrick Garland to Gorsuch, you know, breaking of that, you know, breaking of that norm and not allowing Obama to fill that seat. And then everything that happened with Kavanaugh, right?
Yeah.
And Kavanaugh is widely
used as an illegitimate.
Yep. I mean, and we're in the same boat. So if the Supreme Court, if it's Bush v. Gore again, where the Supreme Court steps in and says, oh yes, well, in our considered legal opinion, you know, we're just calling balls and strikes here. We're going to award the election to Trump. You know, then in that case, what do our sort of quote unquote opposition leaders do, which is Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, Joe Biden, the candidate himself, who is ostensibly the leader of the party.
Right.
What does Barack Obama do in that situation? And nothing that I've seen over the past 5 years has led me to believe that they would mount a really serious challenge to a stealing of an election or of him remaining in office. Like, because that's the other thing is what happens if he gets defeated, declares shenanigans, says, oh, actually, I didn't lose, but the Democrats cheated, so I'm not going to leave office. Like, what happens then? How do you push? How do you pull? And, you know, it's great to sit around and talk with my friends about, you know, where we have to seriously, like, okay, well, what does the army do in that situation? And you're never in a good place as a society.
When that's the question.
If I think what the answer is, I think that the military establishment hates Trump.
Yeah.
And on a individual level, in terms of like the personalities between him and the generals, and then institutionally between the Pentagon and him, it's like the Pentagon is actually not in Trump's corner.
So
what would they do? They're not going to back him. And that's reassuring. But it's never great to be in a place where you're feeling reassured because you're pretty sure that the army like won't go with Trump.
Right. Yeah. And the intelligence community is going to be like, which I mean, one of my big problems with the Dems is this narrative and acting like the intelligence community will save us. Although in this one rare, I mean, I do think that this would be a time where they potentially could. And then, of course, the question, because I don't think they would go along with a Trump thing, you know, a legal thing. But he could win through the Electoral College. And
absolutely.
The biggest thing is, of course, and I feel kind of conflicted about this. I think there's a dangerous, like people's hearts are in the right place, but this discourse around looting, which I think looting is not the same as at all as like a cop who is paid to ostensibly keep law and order and protect citizens. Like, like that is not the same. At the same time, I think that there's been a kind of, an almost shaming of people who question looting as a tactic in a way that I worry, like we will, the non-Trumpers and the people who not the never Trumpers, but like the original OG were, you know, we never liked Trump. We weren't Republicans. Like our side, the leftists, the progressives, like we are outarmed. There is nothing. Like, I don't care how worthy the cause is. Like we are not going to be able to do an armed
correct
revolution, right? And so I just think that that's something that we have to like be where, you know, careful with. And there's a real, and maybe this is just an online thing and this doesn't like resonate with most people, but there's a real, I think, like shame, like how dare you question violence when it's the police? I'm like, I know the police are the violent ones. Like, I totally know that. And I don't think looting is at all the equivalent of that. But just as a tactic, like we have to start thinking about what's going to happen because we're not going to be able to do it with arms.
Yeah. And that requires a critical mass of people. because right. you have a critical mass of people who will almost certainly be operating under conditions where Trump will declare a state of national emergency.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Because there's been a resurgence of COVID and everybody has to stay inside their house, so you actually
right,
can't come
right.
out.
We're like less. It's less. I mean, it was never possible, but it's less possible now.
Right.
Than ever.
But
yeah.
Things still could get out of hand.
Right. No, shit could hit the fan big time. It's just gonna boomerang back onto.
Correct. It's not going to be good. And because also the people who are armed are, you know, the Boogaloo people,
right,
those
exactly.
militia type are going to come out and they will fight
right.
back.
Right.
And so when I talk about a revolutionary moment, right, like, you know, this was all true roughly too of, you know, the people of Paris in 1789, people of Paris in 1830. And a lot of it comes down to will, which is, you know, I wrote a little thing here in the book. I'll give you a preview of the book
because this is
a thing that wound up in the book is like when so
in
like
your
when
new
the,
book?
Yeah, the new book, yeah, which great. Is not which is called Hero of Two Worlds, the Marquis de Lafayette in the Age of Revolution.
And when does that come out?
It'll come out in June of next year.
Oh, great.
Yeah, so I'm finishing the manuscript right now.
Hopefully the planet will be still around.
Yeah. I hope.
Yeah.
And I would like to go on a book tour. You know, I really like books. And I don't know if it's going to happen, which is kind of depressing.
I know, yeah.
But I'll put on a brave face. There are worse things than not being able to go on a book tour.
Yeah.
But there's this thing like, so when, like in 1781, when Cornwallis lost at Yorktown, and there was no reason why that necessarily had to be the end of the American War of Independence, right? The British were a large empire. They were very wealthy. They could have taken out new loans. They could have built new ships. They could have conscripted new forces. They could have sent them across the Atlantic. They could have gone right back to work because, you know, Cornwallis was only leading, you know, 7,000-10,000 people.
Yeah.
So they could have kept the war going. They had the material ability to keep the war going. They still continued to outgun the American forces. You know, they could have outlasted the French probably in terms of their ability to raise men, money, and material. But the thing is that by 1781, everybody in like London and in Westminster was like, this is pointless. We don't want to do this anymore. This is a sunk thing and we don't want to do it anymore. So, and this is something that Clausewitz talks about too in On War, which is war and conflict is not a game of like how many battleships can you destroy and how many planes can you shoot down and how many bullets can you fire. It is how do you break the will of your opponent. And if you break the will of your opponent to continue the fight, it doesn't matter how many guns they have or how many ships they have. If they don't want to use them, if they don't have the will to actually use them, then you win. And if you don't have anything, if you have been stripped of everything, but your will is still with you, then what do? You pick up a rock and you throw it.
Right.
And you keep the war going. And the war never dies. And there are lots of places throughout the world where the war has never ended, right? Where people are continuing to pick up rocks and throw them, even though they are outgunned. So in this sense, does the American military establishment and its police forces massively outgun any kind of what I would say like progressive or left-wing popular challenge or street mobilization to actually like build barricades and stage a revolution in the way that we would think of one happening in 1830 or 1848 or the Paris Commune or anything like that. Like, yes. But is there a possibility that they could, that kind of movement could break the will of the people who would be giving those orders to ever actually give those orders? Yes, I think that that's possible. Now, Tiananmen Square, right? They tried that and the Chinese government said, nope, we're going to do it. We're going to go ahead and roll in. We're going to roll in with the tanks and we're going to mow these people down and we are going to give that order. Lots of times in lots of places, they refused to give that order. They wouldn't give that order. And this is partly what happened when the Berlin Wall came down and when the Cold War ended. A lot of that was mass mobilized, just people standing around in a place and then the government officials being unwilling to actually at that point give the order to open fire and do, you know, let's roll the tanks into Budapest.
Right.
and crushed these people. Now we don't want to do that.
Right.
So there is a possibility that no matter how many, you know, whatever the armament, whatever the guns at their disposal is, if enough people are mad, and I don't know what it is, because you can talk about, you know, really agitated left-wing people. Okay. That's not enough. Right. That's not even right. close to enough. Yeah. Certainly not the United States of America.
Yeah. No. Yeah. Right. Right.
It is a tiny, tiny, tiny minority of a minority. So you need the moms, right? That's who you're talking about. Or what happened just now in Portland.
Right. There was a night
where the moms went and linked arms. And if you sent the moms of America, who are pissed about their kids and their schooling situation, who are upset about the fact that they don't have jobs or that they might lose their jobs, who are upset because they haven't seen their parents, they're upset because they haven't seen their grandkids, they're upset because of the way Donald Trump has treated the country, they're upset because they know people who have died of COVID, they're upset because they have just now watched him very possibly steal an election. You send that energy jolting through the country, maybe you do get, you know, maybe those suburbanites, maybe those moms, who's really what we're taking, you know, if the moms of America go out there, you know, and Trump says, all right, mow them down.
Right.
Are people going to follow?
Bad optics.
That's optics that's so bad. Let's see. Does Mitch McConnell have a soul? Maybe he does.
Yeah. I don't know if he does. I don't think he does, but I think it causes defecting. It could cause defecting.
Yeah. And then at that point you could have, the kind of defection that would create something else. So that's what it is. You know, the United States is never going to see a left-wing revolution, you know, like Cuba or even like Russia.
Right.
It's far, far more likely that the country goes, you know, that it's Spanish Civil War time.
Right.
And it's, you know, it's Franco. It's
hopefully
Franco.
The good guys win this time, though.
Yeah, Franco's for America in the 21st century, which is, you know, honestly, not to end this on a downbeat, probably the most likely scenario.
Yeah.
Because that's what America structurally and emotionally and socially is far more primed for, that for kind of, capitalist fascism rather than, you know, socialism.
Yeah, or even like social democracy.
Even though social democracy polls really well.
I know. That's why we got to,
just want things, and people are like, yeah,
I know.
It's like, okay, well, this guy wants to give it to you. Oh, well, no, I don't know.
This has been amazing, and I could talk to you for longer. This is just part one. We've, to quote, I believe, that someone who I don't really like to cite because she's not the most inspirational figure, but I believe it's Karen Carpenter. We've only just begun.
Right. Well, I thank you for the opportunity to indulge in my inner Cassandra yet again.
Yeah, no, it's awesome.
My favorite thing.
And and I have so many like much nerdier questions about the Roman Empire empire, what revolution means, like what the definition is, because that's such a fraught type kind of like question, revolution versus coup.
I have to come up with a definition of revolution.
I know.
Oh, geez. Well, I didn't think that was due until the end of Revolution's podcast, when was going to have to sit down and say, okay, it's in my,
Your to-do list. It's on your to-do list.
Because at the beginning, if you listen to the intro episode, I'm like, a revolution is anything that looks like a revolution.
Right.
And then I decided I should probably come up with a pretty decent definition by the series.
And I want to know your, best revolution, worst revolution, biggest fake, you know, we can talk about lots of things, but biggest.
Okay.
Fantastic. And I think like this is, and then also like what is to be done, right? Because I think we got to a lot of like the setup, and now how do we deal with it? So I'm excited about that part two. And where can people, anything you want to make sure people know to follow?
So the Revolutions podcast exists. It's currently on hiatus while I finish the book, but I'll be coming back in a couple months to do part two of the Russian Revolution. I did everything through 1905, and then we're going to pick it up from 1905 and run it to the end. I also did the History of Rome, which is also available on iTunes and anywhere podcasts are found. I have a book called The Storm Before the Storm, The Beginning of the End of the Roman Republic, about the decline and fall of the Roman Republic.
Right.
And I'm currently writing Hero of Two Worlds, The Marquis de Lafayette in the Age of Revolution, which is about him in three revolutions, because it's the American Revolution, the French Revolution, and then he comes back around as a pudgy old man to put back on his National Guard uniform one last time in July of 1830 and plant the Republican kiss on Louis-Philippe.
The best mug to kiss.
Oh, God.
The best.
He was a pear.
Yeah, pear. The best pear-shaped
the
mug.
The best pear. Yeah, there were a couple of pears up there.
Yeah, lots of pears.
That's how Daumier always depicted Louis-Philippe, was as a pear.
Yeah. Could be worse. In fact, he called him Mon Pear. Just kidding. And yeah, thank you so much. And everyone, check out those podcasts if you haven't already. They're addictive.
And I'm on Twitter mostly at Mike Duncan.
Okay. You're back on.
Because I was like a weirdly early adopter of Twitter.
Yeah.
So it's just my name, Mike Duncan, okay. Which is
awesome.
Wild.
All right. Thank you so much.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks. And to hear the rest of this discussion, which hasn't happened yet, with Mike Duncan, come on down to my YouTube channel Sunday, September 13th. At noon Eastern Standard Time, and we will be continuing it live. And that's youtube.com/The Katie Helper Show. Thanks again so much for listening to The Katie Helper Show. Our theme song is by the band Cordova.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.